Chapter 16. The Last of Man. 1. Sentence of Death. Ours has been essentially a philosophical age, in fact, the supreme age of philosophy. But a great practical problem has also concerned us. We've had to prepare for the task of preserving humanity during a most difficult period, which was calculated to begin about 100 million years hence, but might in certain circumstances be sprung upon us at very short notice. Long ago, the human inhabitants of Venus believed that already in their day the sun was about to enter the white dwarf phase, and that the time would therefore soon come when their world would be frostbound. This calculation was unduly pessimistic, but we now know that even allowing for the slight delay caused by the great collision, the solar collapse must begin at some date astronomically not very distant. We had planned that during the comparatively brief period of the actual shrinkage, we would move our planet steadily nearer to the sun until finally it should settle in the narrowest possible orbit. Man would then be comfortably placed for a very long period. But in the fullness of time, there would come a far more serious crisis. The sun would continue to cool, and at last man would no longer be able to live by means of solar radiation. It would become necessary to annihilate matter to supply the deficiency. The other planets might be used for this purpose, and possibly the sun itself. Or given the sustenance for so long a voyage, man might boldly project his planet into the neighbourhood of some younger star. Thenceforth, perhaps, he might operate upon a far grander scale. He might explore and colonize all suitable worlds in every corner of the galaxy, and organize himself as a vast community of minded worlds. Even, so we dreamed, he might achieve intercourse with other galaxies. It did not seem impossible that man himself was the germ of the world soul, which we still hope is destined to awake for a while before the universal decline, and to crown the eternal cosmos with its due of knowledge and admiration, fleeting yet eternal. We dare to think that in some far distant epoch, the human spirit, clad in all wisdom, power, and delight, might look back upon our primitive age with a certain respect, no doubt with pity also and amusement, but nonetheless with admiration for the spirit in us, still only half awake and struggling against great disabilities. In such a mood, half pity, half admiration, we ourselves look back upon the primitive mankinds. Our prospect has now suddenly and completely changed, for astronomers have made a startling discovery which assigns man a speedy end. His existence has ever been precarious. At any stage of his career he might easily have been exterminated by some slight alteration of his chemical environment, by a more than usually malignant microbe, by a radical change of climate, or by the manifold effects of his own folly. Twice already he has been almost destroyed by astronomical events. How easily might it happen that the solar system, now rushing through a somewhat more crowded region of the galaxy, should become entangled with or actually strike a major astronomical body and be destroyed. But fate, as it turns out, has a more surprising end in store for man. Not long ago, an unexpected alteration was observed to be taking place in a near star. Though no discoverable cause, it began to change from white to violet and increase in brightness. Already it has attained such extravagant brilliance that though its actual disk remains a mere point in our sky, its dazzling purple radiance illuminates our nocturnal landscapes with hideous beauty. Our astronomers have ascertained that this is no ordinary nova, that it is not one of those stars addicted to paroxysms of brilliance. It is something unprecedented, a normal star suffering from a unique disease, a fantastic acceleration of its vital process, a riotous squandering of the energy which should have remained locked within its substance for eons. At the present rate, it will be reduced either to an inert cinder or to actual annihilation in a few thousand years. This extraordinary event may possibly have been produced by unwise tamperings on the part of intelligent beings in the star's neighbourhood. But indeed, since all matter at very high temperature is in a state of unstable equilibrium, the cause may have been merely some conjunction of natural circumstances. The event was first regarded simply as an intriguing spectacle, but further study roused a more serious interest. Our own planet, and therefore the Sun also, was suffering a continuous and increasing bombardment of ethereal vibrations, most of which were of incredible high frequency and of unknown potentiality. What would be their effect upon the Sun? After some centuries, certain astronomical bodies in the neighbourhood of the deranged star were seen to be infected with its disorder. Their fever increased the splendour of our night sky, but it also confirmed our fears. We still hoped that the Sun might prove too distant to be seriously influenced, but careful analysis now showed that this hope must be abandoned. The Sun's remoteness might cause a delay of some thousands of years before the cumulative effects of the bombardment could start the disintegration, but sooner or later the Sun itself must be infected. Probably within 30,000 years, life will be impossible anywhere within a vast radius of the Sun, so vast a radius that it is quite impossible to propel our planet away fast enough to escape before the storm can catch us. 2. Behaviour of the Condemned. The discovery of this doom kindled in us unfamiliar emotions. Hitherto humanity had seemed to be destined for a very long future, and the individual himself had been accustomed to look forward to very many thousands of years of personal life ending in voluntary sleep. We had, of course, often conceived and even savoured in imagination the sudden destruction of our world. But now we faced it as a fact. Outwardly, everyone behaved with perfect serenity, but inwardly every mind was in turmoil. Not that there was any question of our falling into panic or despair, for in this crisis our native detachment stood us in good stead. But inevitably some time passed before our minds became properly adjusted to the new prospect, before we could see our fate outlined clearly and beautifully against the cosmic background. Presently, however, we learn to contemplate the whole great saga of man as a completed work of art, and to admire it no less for its sudden and tragic end than for the promise in which it was not to be fulfilled. Grief was now transfigured wholly into ecstasy. Defeat, which had oppressed us with a sense of man's impotence and littleness among the stars, brought us into a new sympathy and reverence for all those myriads of beings in the past out of whose obscure strivings we had been born. We saw the most brilliant of our own race and the lowliest of our pre-human forerunners as essentially spirits of equal excellence, though cast in diverse circumstances. When we looked around on the heavens and at the violet splendour which was to destroy us, we were filled with awe and pity, awe for the inconceivable potentiality of this bright host, pity for its self-thwarting effort to fulfil itself as the universal spirit. At this stage it seemed that there was nothing left for us to do but to crowd as much excellence as possible into our remaining life and meet our end in the noblest manner. But now there came upon us once more the rare experience of racial mentality. For a whole Neptunian year, every individual lived in an enraptured trance, in which, as the racial mind, he or she resolved many ancient mysteries and saluted many unexpected beauties. This ineffable experience, lived through under the shadow of death, was the flower of man's whole being. But I can tell nothing of it, save that when it was over, we possessed, even as individuals, a new peace, in which strangely but harmoniously were blended grief, exultation, and godlike laughter. In consequence of this racial experience, we found ourselves faced with two tasks which had not before been contemplated. The one referred to the future, the other to the past. In respect of the future, we are now setting about the forlorn task of disseminating among the stars the seeds of a new humanity. For this purpose, we shall make use of the pressure of radiation from the sun, and chiefly the extravagant, potent radiation that will later be available. We are hoping to devise extremely minute electromagnetic wave systems akin to normal protons and electrons, which will be individually capable of sailing forward upon the hurricane of solar radiation at a speed not wholly incomparable with the speed of light itself. This is a difficult task. But further, these units must be so cunningly interrelated that in favourable conditions they may tend to combine to form spores of life, and to develop not indeed into human beings, but into lowly organisms with a definite evolutionary bias towards the essentials of human nature. These objects we shall project from beyond our atmosphere in immense quantities at certain points of our planet's orbit, so that solar radiation may carry them toward the most promising regions of the galaxy. The chance that any of them will survive to reach their destination is small, and still smaller the chance that any of them will find a suitable environment. But if any of this human seed should fall upon good ground, it will embark, we hope, upon a somewhat rapid biological evolution, and produce in due season whatever complex organic forms are possible in its environment. It will have a very real physiological bias towards the evolution of intelligence. Indeed, it will have a much greater bias in that direction than occurred on the Earth in those sub-vital atomic groupings from which terrestrial life eventually sprang. It is just conceivable, then, that by extreme good fortune, man may still influence the future of this galaxy, not directly, but through his creature. But in the vast music of existence, the actual theme of mankind now ceases forever. Finished the long reiterations of man's history, defeated the whole proud enterprise of his maturity, the stored experience of many mankinds must sink into oblivion, and today's wisdom must vanish. The other task which occupies us, that which relates to the past, is one which may well seem to you nonsensical. We have long been able to enter into past minds and participate in their experience. Hitherto we have been passive spectators merely, but recently we have acquired the power of influencing past minds. This seems an impossibility, for a past event is what it is, and how can it conceivably be altered at a subsequent date, even in the minutest respect? Now it is true that past events are what they are irrevocably, but in certain cases some feature of a past event may depend on an event in the far future. The past event would never have been as it actually was and is eternally if there had not been going to be a certain future event which, though not contemporaneous with the past event, influences it directly in the sphere of eternal being. The passage of events is real, and time is the successiveness of passing events. But though events have passage, they have also eternal being. And in certain rare cases, mental events, far separated in time, determine one another directly by way of eternity. Our own minds have been profoundly influenced by direct inspection of past minds, and now we find that certain events of certain past minds are determined by present events in our own present minds. No doubt there are some past mental events which are what they are by virtue of mental processes which we shall perform, but have not yet performed. Our historians and psychologists engaged on direct inspection of past minds had often complained of certain singular points in past minds where the ordinary laws of psychology fail to give a full explanation of the course of mental events, where in fact some wholly unknown influence seemed to be at work. Later it was found that in some cases at least, this disturbance of the ordinary principles of psychology corresponded with certain thoughts or desires in the mind of the observer, living in our own age. Of course, only such matters as could have significance to the past mind could influence it at all. Thoughts and desires of ours, which have no meaning to the particular past individual, fail to enter into his experience. New ideas and new values are only to be introduced by arranging familiar matter so that it may gain a new significance. Nevertheless, we now found ourselves in possession of an amazing power of communicating with the past and contributing to its thought and action, though of course we could not alter it. But it may be asked what, if in respect of a particular singularity in some past mind, we do not, after all, choose to provide the necessary influence to account for it. The question is meaningless. There is no possibility that we should not choose to influence those past minds which are, as a matter of fact, dependent on our influence. For it is in the sphere of eternity, wherein alone we meet past minds, that we really make this free choice. And in the sphere of time, though the choosing has relations with our modern age and may be said to occur in that age, it also has relations with the past mind and may be said to have occurred also long ago. There are in some past minds singularities which are not the product of any influence that we have exerted today. Some of these singularities, no doubt, we shall ourselves produce on some occasion before our destruction. But it may be that some are due to an influence other than ours, perhaps to beings which, by good fortune, may spring long hence from our forlorn seminal enterprise, or they may be due, perhaps, to the cosmic mind whose future occurrence and eternal existence we earnestly desire. However that may be, there are a few remarkable minds scattered up and down past ages and even in the most primitive human races which suggest an influence other than our own. They are so singular in one respect or another that we cannot give a perfectly clear psychological account of them in terms of the past only, and yet we ourselves are not the instigators of their singularity. Your Jesus, your Socrates, your Gautama shows traces of this uniqueness. But the most original of all were too eccentric to have any influence on their contemporaries. It is possible that in ourselves also there are singularities which cannot be accounted for wholly in terms of ordinary biological and psychological laws. If we could prove that this is the case, we should have very definite evidence of the occurrence of a high order of mentality somewhere in the future, and therefore of its eternal existence. But hitherto this problem has proved too subtle for us, even in the racial mode. It may be that the mere fact that we have succeeded in attaining racial mentality involves some remote future influence. It is even conceivable that every creative advance that any mind has ever made involves unwitting cooperation with the cosmic mind, which perhaps will awake at some date before the end. We have two methods of influencing the past through past individuals, for we can operate either upon minds of great originality and power, or upon any average individual whose circumstances happen to suit our purpose. In original minds, we can only suggest some very vague intuition, which is then worked up by the individual himself into some form very different from that which we intended, but very potent as a factor in the culture of his age. Average minds, on the other hand, we can use as passive instruments for the conveyance of detailed ideas. But in such cases, the individual is incapable of working up the material into a great and potent form suited to his age. But what is it, you ask, that we seek to contribute to the past? We seek to afford intuitions of truth and of value, which, though easy to us from our point of vantage, would be impossible to the unaided past. We seek to help the past to make the best of itself, just as one man may help another. We seek to direct the attention of past individuals and past races to truths and beauties which, though implicit in their experience, would otherwise be overlooked. We seek to do this for two reasons. Entering into past minds, we become perfectly acquainted with them and cannot but love them, and so we desire to help them. By influencing selected individuals, we seek to influence indirectly great multitudes. But our second motive is very different. We see the career of man in his successive planetary homes as a process of very great beauty. It is far indeed from the perfect, but it is very beautiful, with the beauty of tragic art. Now it turns out that this beautiful thing entails our operation at various points in the past. Therefore we will to operate. Unfortunately, our first inexperienced efforts were disastrous. Many of the fatuities which primitive minds in all ages have been prone to attribute to the influence of disembodied spirits, whether deities, fiends, or the dead, are but the gibberish which resulted from our earliest experiments. And this book, so admirable in our conception, has issued from the brain of the writer, your contemporary, in such disorder as to be mostly rubbish. We are concerned with the past not only in so far as we make very rare contributions to it, but chiefly in two other manners. First, we're engaged upon the great enterprise of becoming lovingly acquainted with the past, the human past, in every detail. This is, so to speak, our supreme act of filial piety. When one being comes to know and love another, a new and beautiful thing is created, namely the love. The cosmos is thus far and at that date enhanced. We seek then to know and love every past mind that we can enter. In most cases, we can know them with far more understanding than they can know themselves. Not the least of them, not the worst of them, shall be left out of this great work of understanding and admiration. There is another manner in which we are concerned with the human past. We need its help. For we who are triumphantly reconciled to our fate are under obligation to devote our last energies not to ecstatic contemplation, but to a forlorn and most uncongenial task, the dissemination. This task is almost intolerably repugnant to us. Gladly we would spend our last days in embellishing our community and our culture, and in pious exploration of the past. But it is incumbent on us, who are by nature artists and philosophers, to direct the whole attention of our world upon the arid labour of designing an artificial human seed, producing it in immense quantities, and projecting it among the stars. If there is to be any possibility of success, we must undertake a very lengthy programme of physical research and finally organise a worldwide system of manufacture. The work will not be completed until our physical constitution is already being undermined and the disintegration of our community has already begun. Now, we could never fulfil this policy without a zealous conviction of its importance. Here it is that the past can help us. We, who have now learnt so thoroughly the supreme art of ecstatic fatalism, go humbly to the past to learn over again that other supreme achievement of the spirit, loyalty to the forces of life, embattled against the forces of death. Wandering among the heroic and often forlorn ventures of the past, we are fired once more with primitive zeal. Thus, when we return to our own world, we are able, even while we preserve in our hearts the peace that passeth understanding, to struggle as though we cared only for victory. 3. Epilogue. I'm speaking to you now from a period about 20,000 terrestrial years after the date at which the whole preceding part of this book was communicated. It's become very difficult to reach you, and still more difficult to speak to you, for already the last men are not the men they were. Our two great undertakings are still unfinished. Much of the human past remains imperfectly explored, and the projection of the seed is scarcely begun. That enterprise has proved far more difficult than was expected. Only within the last few years have we succeeded in designing an artificial human dust capable of being carried forward on the sun's radiation, hardly enough to endure the conditions of a transgalactic voyage of many millions of years, and yet intricate enough to bear the potentiality of life and of spiritual development. We're now preparing to manufacture this seminal matter in great quantities and to cast it into space at suitable points on the planet's orbit. Some centuries have now passed since the sun began to show the first symptoms of disintegration, namely a slight change of colour toward the blue, followed by a definite increase of brightness and heat. Today, when he pierces the ever-thickening cloud, he smites us with an intolerable steely brilliance which destroys the sight of anyone foolish enough to face it. Even in the cloudy weather, which is now normal, the eye is wounded by the fierce violet glare. Eye troubles afflict us all, in spite of the special glasses which have been designed to protect us. The mere heat, too, is already destructive. We are forcing our planet outward from its old orbit in an ever-widening spiral. But do what we will, we cannot prevent the climate from becoming more and more deadly, even at the poles. The intervening regions have already been deserted. Evaporation of the equatorial oceans have thrown the whole atmosphere into tumult, so that even at the poles we are tormented by hot, wet hurricanes and incredible electric storms. These have already shattered most of our great buildings, sometimes burying a whole teeming province under an avalanche of tumbled vitreous crags. Our two polar communities at first managed to maintain radio communication, but it is now some time since we of the South received news of the more distressed North. Even with us the situation is already desperate. We had recently established some hundreds of stations for the dissemination, but less than a score have been able to operate. This failure is due mainly to an increasing lack of personnel. The deluge of fantastic solar radiation has had disastrous effect on the human organism. Epidemics of a malignant tumour which medical science has failed to conquer have reduced the southern people to a mere remnant, and this in spite of the migration of the tropical races into the Antarctic. Each of us, moreover, is but the wreckage of his former self. The higher mental functions attained only in the most developed human species are already lost or disordered through the breakdown of their special tissues. Not only has the racial mind vanished, but the sexual groups have lost their mental unity. Three of the subsexes have already been exterminated by derangement of their chemical nature. Glandular troubles, indeed, have unhinged many of us with anxieties and loathings which we cannot conquer, though we know them to be unreasonable. Even the normal power of telepathic communication has become so unreliable that we have been compelled to fall back upon the archaic practice of vocal symbolism. Exploration of the past is now confined to specialists, and is a dangerous profession which may lead to disorders of temporal experience. Degeneration of the higher neural centres has also brought about in us a far more serious and deep-seated trouble, namely a general spiritual degradation which would formerly have seemed impossible, so confident were we of our integrity. The perfectly dispassionate will have been for many millions of years universal among us, and the cornerstone of our whole society and culture. We had almost forgotten that it has a physiological basis, and if that basis were undermined, we might no longer be capable of rational conduct. But drenched for some thousands of years by the unique stellar radiation, we have gradually lost not only the ecstasy of dispassionate worship, but even the capacity for normal disinterested behaviour. Everyone is now liable to an irrational bias in favour of himself as a private person as against his fellows. Personal envy, uncharitableness, even murder and gratuitous cruelty, formerly unknown amongst us, are now becoming common. At first, when men began to notice in themselves these archaic impulses, they crushed them with amused contempt. But as the highest nerve centres fell further into decay, the brute in us began to be ever more unruly, and the human more uncertain. Rational conduct was henceforth to be achieved only after an exhausting and degrading moral struggle, instead of spontaneously and fluently. Nay, worse, increasingly often the struggle ended not in victory, but defeat. Imagine, then, the terror and disgust that gripped us when we found ourselves, one and all, condemned to a desperate struggle against impulses which we had been accustomed to regard as insane. It is distressing enough to know that each one of us might at any moment, merely to help some dear individual or other, betray his supreme duty toward the dissemination. But it is harrowing to discover ourselves sometimes so far sunk as to be incapable even of common loving-kindness towards our neighbours. For a man to favour himself against his friend or beloved, even in the slightest respect, was formerly unknown. But today, many of us are haunted by the look of amazed horror and pity in the eyes of an injured friend. In the early stages of our trouble, lunatic asylums were founded, but they soon became overcrowded and a burden on a stricken community. The insane were then killed, but it became clear that by former standards we were all insane. No man can now trust himself to behave reasonably, and of course we cannot trust each other, partly through the prevalent irrationality of desire, and partly through the misunderstandings which have come with the loss of telepathic communication. We have been plunged into all manner of discords. A political constitution and system of laws had to be devised, but they seem to have increased our troubles. Order of a kind is maintained by an overworked police force. But this is in the hands of the professional organisers who've now all the vices of bureaucracy. It was largely through their folly that two of the Antarctic nations broke into social revolution and are now preparing to meet the armament which an insane world government is devising for their destruction. Meanwhile, through the breakdown of the economic order and the impossibility of reaching the food factories on Jupiter, starvation is added to our troubles and has afforded to certain ingenious lunatics the opportunity of trading at the expense of others. All this folly in a doomed world, and in a community that was yesterday the very flower of a galaxy. Those of us who still care for the life of the spirit are tempted to regret that mankind did not choose decent suicide before ever the putrescence began. But indeed this could not be. The task that was undertaken had to be completed, for the scattering of the seed has come to be for every one of us the supreme religious duty. Even those who continually sin against it recognize this as the last office of man. It was for this that we outstayed our time and must watch ourselves decline from spiritual estate into that brutishness from which man has so seldom freed himself. Yet why do we persist in the forlorn effort? Even if by good luck the seed should take root somewhere and thrive, there will surely come an end to its adventure, if not swiftly, in fire, then in the ultimate battle of life against encroaching frost. Our labour will at best sow for death an ampler harvest. There seems no rational defence of it, unless it be rational to carry out blindly a purpose conceived in a former and more enlightened state. But we cannot feel sure that we really were more enlightened. We look back now at our former selves with wonder, but also with incomprehension and misgiving. We try to recall the glory that seemed to be revealed to each of us in the racial mind, but we remember almost nothing of it. We cannot rise even to that more homely beatitude which was once within the reach of the unaided individual, that serenity which it seemed should be the spirit's answer to every tragic event. It is gone from us. It is not only impossible, but inconceivable. We now see our private distresses and the public calamity as merely hideous, that after so long a struggle into maturity, man should be roasted alive like a trapped mouse for the entertainment of a lunatic. How can any beauty lie in that? But this is not our last word to you, for though we have fallen, there is still something in us left over from the time that is past. We have become blind and weak, but the knowledge that we are so has forced us to a great effort. Those of us who have not already sunk too far have formed themselves into a brotherhood for mutual strengthening, so that the true human spirit may be maintained a little longer until the seed has been well sown and death be permissible. We call ourselves the Brotherhood of the Condemned. We seek to be faithful to one another and to our common undertaking and to the vision which is no longer revealed. We are vowed to the comforting of all distressed persons who are not yet permitted death. We are vowed also to the dissemination, and we are vowed to keep the spirit bright until the end. Now and again we meet together in little groups or great companies to hearten ourselves with one another's presence. Sometimes on these occasions we can but sit in silence, groping for consolation and for strength. Sometimes the spoken word flickers hither and thither amongst us, shedding a brief light but little warmth to the soul that lies freezing in a torrid world. But there is among us one moving from place to place and company to company, whose voice all long to hear. He is young, the last born of the last men, for he was the latest to be conceived before we learned man's doom and put an end to all conceiving. Being the latest, he is also the noblest. Not him alone, but all his generation we salute and look to for strength. But he, the youngest, is different from the rest. In him the spirit, which is but the flesh awakened into spirituality, has power to withstand the tempest of solar energy longer than the rest of us. It is as though the sun itself were eclipsed by this spirit's brightness. It is as though in him, at last and for a day only, man's promise were fulfilled. For though, like others, he suffers in the flesh, he is above his suffering. And though more than the rest of us, he feels the suffering of others. He is above his pity. In his comforting, there is a strange, sweet raillery which can persuade the sufferer to smile at his own pain. When this youngest brother of ours contemplates with us our dying world and the frustration of all man's striving, he is not, like us, dismayed, but quiet. In the presence of such quietness, despair wakens into peace. By his reasonable speech, almost by the mere sound of his voice, our eyes are opened and our hearts mysteriously filled with exultation. Yet often his words are grave. Let his words, not mine, close this story. Great are the stars, and man is of no account to them. But man is a fair spirit, whom a star conceived and a star kills. He is greater than those bright, blind companies. For though in them there is incalculable potentiality, in him there is achievement, small but actual. Too soon, seemingly, he comes to his end. But when he is done, he will not be nothing, not as though he had never been, for he is eternally a beauty in the eternal form of things. Man was winged hopefully. He had in him to go further than this short flight now ending. He proposed even that he should become the flower of all things, and that he should learn to be the all-knowing, the all-admiring. Instead, he is to be destroyed. He is only a fledgling, caught in a bushfire. He is very small, very simple, very little capable of insight. His knowledge of the great orb of things is but a fledgling's knowledge. His admiration is a nestling's admiration for the things kindly to his own small nature. He delights only in food and the food-announcing call. The music of the sphere passes over him, through him, and is not heard. Yet it has used him, and now it uses his destruction. Great and terrible and very beautiful is the whole, and for man the best is that the whole should use him. But does it really use him? Is the beauty of the whole really enhanced by our agony, and is the whole really beautiful? And what is beauty? Throughout all his existence, man has been striving to hear the music of the spheres and to seem to himself once and again to catch some phrase of it, or even a hint of the whole form of it. Yet he can never be sure that he has truly heard it, nor even that there is any such perfect music at all to be heard. Inevitably so, for if it exists, it is not for him in his littleness. But one thing is certain. Man himself, at the very least, is music, a brave theme that makes music also of its vast accompaniment, its matrix of storms and stars. Man himself, in his degree, is eternally a beauty in the eternal form of things. It is very good to have been man, and so we may go forward together with laughter in our hearts and peace, thankful for the past and for our own courage. For we shall make, after all, a fair conclusion to this brief music that is man. Afterword. I first encountered Last and First Men when I was a girl in the old southern Rhodesia, which is a surprising enough fact in itself. It was years, long after I came to England, before I met anyone who was interested in Olaf Stapledon. But in an isolated farmhouse in the bush, some lonely and eccentric reader said to me, "You must read this if you never read anything else." The words remain if she or he remains shadowy. Billions of years and starry perspectives were not a surprise to me, because they were the natural, if not always comfortable, background to how my father thought, and I spent most evenings when young, sitting out in front of the house, watching skies so clear and so crowded with different densities of luminosity that now, in our polluted time, it is hard to believe they existed. But in the extreme silences of the bush at night, heightened by the calls and movements of birds and animals, it was as if the stars faintly clashed and sibilantly whispered. After an hour or so of lying back in a deck chair, staring up, eyes drenched with starlight, it was evident that space was far from soundless, and you felt that all you had to do was to take a running step or two, and then you'd be off, not into immense silences and emptiness, but into a universe alive with sound and movement. Stapledon's visions could easily have had their genesis in Africa, and for a time I was even convinced that he must have watched stars there. But in fact he lived on the Wirral Peninsula, which is defined by the rivers Dee and Mersey, not far from Liverpool. He had a telescope on his roof and spent nights watching the movements of the skies. He had degrees in history and philosophy and was a tutor in adult education. This last pleases me because original and independent minds are so often to be met in the sphere of adult and community work. Last and First Men, 1930, led to an exchange with H.G. Wells, who admired the book. Successive books, particularly Star Maker, 1937, won him a growing circle of admirers, which later came to include science fiction writers like Arthur C. Clarke, Theodore Sturgeon, Brian Aldiss, and Stanislaw Lem. I think it's likely that he influences people as he did me. Hard to say exactly how, but he leaves an admiration for his audaciousness and his claim as an imaginative writer on the kind of thinking astronomical discoveries were making commonplace. Surely, too, what was going on in archaeology influenced him, because the boundaries of human beginnings and development were being pushed further back with every year. Brian Aldiss claims as an influence Winwood Reade's Martyrdom of Man, and I think he's right. Books that have been overtaken by changing ideas can have an enormous effect before they disappear. What made this extraordinary man? What star shone on his cradle? Who knows? Who can ever tell what brings these originals into astonishing existence? There was nothing out of the ordinary in his upbringing, nor in his appearance. His photograph in the uniform of the Society of Friends Ambulance Unit, World War I, shows a thoughtful, self-respecting face. We have the letters he wrote his future wife Agnes during the years of the war when they were separated, she in Australia, he in the trenches. Their interest now, it seems to me, is not so much for the ideas they contain, but because they show how much we have changed, and not for the better. All the old-fashioned words like decency, loyalty, fidelity, chastity have to be brought down from their shelves to describe Olaf's and Agnes's correspondence. But little in it suggests the enormousness of Olaf's mental world. These are romantic letters, but there is nothing romantic or sentimental in Stapledon's vision of the universe, where not only items of humanity may suffer and be swept away in the interest of cosmic whole and billion-year cycles, but the Star Maker, that dark power and lucid intelligence, demands the same of angels and spirits and cosmical creatures. There has been no writer remotely like Stapledon, and there is no one like him now. He wrote before the artificial divisions into science fiction and space fiction and real literature, which he would surely have found ridiculous. He transcended boundaries. To read him means taking a leap out from our provisional and temporary sets of mind into a realm that is beyond current notions of space and time, is somewhere in the future of mankind where we have, as a species, still to set foot. I've recently been re-reading Olaf Stapledon, and can only be grateful that chance put Last and First Men into my hands when I was so young and open to his unique genius. Doris Lessing, January 1988. That was Last and First Men by Olaf Stapledon, read by Stephen Greif.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.